Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast, Ready for a Period of Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Ready for a Period of Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. The coronavirus pandemic, beyond causing a dramatic loss of life around the world, triggered lockdowns and border closures, inflicting serious damage to the global economy. Remittances-dependent countries in Central Asia were particularly challenged. As such that, according to a recent survey by the World Bank, more than 30% of the Tajiks who have been surveyed said that they have reduced their food consumption in comparison to the pre-pandemic times. And a recent report by the Russian Central Bank sheds light on the severity of the problem, where it says the remittances from Russia to Tajikistan fell from 2.5 billion in 2019 to 1.7 billion in 2020. Tajikistan might be affected the most, but the situation in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan are not bright either. So in this episode of the Majlis podcast, we are here to discuss how the Central Asian economy has been coping with the sharp decline in remittances and what the future holds for them. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Irina Kuznetsova, a lecturer in human geography at the University of Birmingham, Karis Schenk, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Nazarbayev University, Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Your Period of Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Wazi. Thank you very much for joining us today on this very, very important conversation, colleagues. So I guess we are still not out from the pandemic, and it is still a big question as to when vaccines will be widely available for people in the region. So it looks like we will be talking about the pandemic as a health crisis for some time to come. In the meantime, its economic impact has already started biting. The recent report, as I said, by the Russian Central Bank about a sharp reduction in remittances to Tajikistan was scary, given remittances make up a large chunk of Tajik GDP. So, Bruce, let's start with you. Please give us an overview of what the report from the Russian Central Bank tells us about the situation of remittances in Central Asia as a whole, and which country stands where in terms of the decline in remittances from Russia.
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned the Tajik figures. I mean, that already shows, you know, it's 30% decline in the amount of remittances. This is not something that we didn't expect, certainly. Mm. You know, it's always a little bit more of a shock when you actually see the figures and realize what it meant. You know, we know that Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are two of the most remittance-dependent countries in the world. Right. You know, the fact that they have less money coming back, another blow to their economy, which is already reeling. Of course, you mentioned the border closures and, you know, everything's down in Kyrgyzstan. And prices went up, too, at the same time. So this is a huge problem for them. Also, Uzbekistan, which wasn't so much remittance-dependent, certainly on Russia for a long, long time, actually had shown some increase prior to the pandemic. You know, and there was even reports that it was, you know, 15% or more of Uzbekistan's economy was dependent upon remittances. So that's obviously going to hurt them, too, at this time. And you know, as you mentioned, that since there's no end in sight to this, you know, you kind of got to wonder what measures the governments can take that they haven't tried already to try to reverse or at least mitigate some of the problems that they have here and ease the suffering on the people. Right. You know, and just one last thing I would say, that, you know, our Uzbek service, of course, reported that last year was such a shock, of course, and it was so bad that there was all the Uzbek migrant laborers in Russia. For the first time, you actually saw a lot of money leaving Uzbekistan and going to Russia to support the out-of-work relatives, you know, who were in Russia and suddenly without work.
Right. No, that's very scary. And also, I think, Irina, you've been looking into the Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan part of the report. So when you look into that as a whole, what stands out to you, particularly with regards to those countries in the report released by the Russian Central Bank?
There is obviously a drop in remittances in Kyrgyzstan. And then I think that we need to have a holistic picture of it, right? Because, first of all, Central Bank reports about official transfers, right?
Right.
But some experts talk about the drop in official transfers as well, doing via informal economy, the cash transfer or hawala, for example. Mm. And then because of social distancing measures, it was less available for migrants. So this drop can be even deeper than central bank demonstrate. But also, for instance, if you look at April, so I think that April was the biggest drop. So it was a 62% in 2020, comparing with 2019. And then if during the year it has been stabilized a little bit, I think that we need to think that what impact could have this massive drops in March, in April, and in June on livelihoods of migrants' families in Kyrgyzstan. But also we need to think about internal migrants in Kyrgyzstan as well, because there were reports about informal settlements in Dordoy and in other areas of Bishkek and Osh as well, where lots of internal migrants from rural areas of Kyrgyzstan live. And then because of lack of job and social distancing measures, so they were not able to feed their families, and this situation is very frustrating, so both with internal and external migration. But now again, I think that it's on the way for stabilization and for increasing our remittances.
That's a very interesting point. Maybe we should come back to that. The signs which tells you that there might be some positive news coming out of the situation. But before that, Karis, what are your understanding of the situation? Particularly, and we have spoken about Tajikistan and to somewhat about Kyrgyzstan. What about the other three Central Asian countries? What you have been witnessing in terms of the impact of the drop in remittances to the local economies and how those impact has in fact seen on the ground in the livelihoods of people on a day-to-day basis?
A couple of points. And one is that, certainly the percentage drop or the percentage change of remittances, especially to Tajikistan, but also Armenia. So the remittances dropped to Armenia by 25%. So that's a figure that's kind of been a little bit lost in these discussions, I think, because, you know, it's another Eurasian Economic Union country, not Central Asia, but another remittance sort of dependent country. As far as Kazakhstan, we don't really see a big impact on there. And then the data coming out of Turkmenistan is really hard to tell. And I think that actually applies to the data coming from Kazakhstan as well. But a couple of observations. One is that if we compare this drop to the previous drop in remittances, which came after the 2014 ruble crisis, actually, things are much better this time around because the entire Russian GDP dropped by 50% in 2015 from 2014. And two individual countries were seeing 40-50% drops in remittances. And we aren't seeing that this time around. And so one of the things that I think is important to remember is that Central Asian migration to Russia is extremely resilient. And it sees ups and downs owing to economic kind of booms and busts and oil prices and all sorts of things, but it is extremely resilient and it does bounce back. And in fact, I think that one of the reasons probably that the slump after 2014 was really slow to recover was because at the same time you had policy change in Russia that made access to documents a lot more restrictive. And I think the combination of economic crisis and kind of restriction of documents together has been a really diabolical sort of mix for Russia that we didn't see after the 2008 crisis. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether we'll see that same sort of thing now, because I think Russia's realizing that there is an extreme demand for migrant workers and there's calls from quite a few sectors of the labor market to really loosen up restrictions in order to, get migrants to Russia and get migrants working. Just one more. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I've kind of a related question, but I will come back to it. Go ahead.
Just one more point on that, and before we move on, and that is that one of the reasons why we didn't see bigger drops in remittances is because all the data shows that migrants largely stayed in Russia when the pandemic hit. In fact, this is a pretty general kind of point of migration theory that when borders become less flexible, migrants tend to stay in migration longer, and migration patterns become more permanent. Mm. And so it'll be interesting to see if that also bears itself out in the longer term in the Eurasian migration system as well.
Right. Karis, you are joining us from Almaty, right, in Kazakhstan?
I'm in Nur Sultan.
Ah, Nur Sultan. Okay. So one thing about Kazakhstan, I mean, we have seen recently that the Kazakhstan also closed border. And again, we have seen these caravans of Uzbekistani migrants coming from Russia and stuck in the Kazakhstani territory, not being able to cross the border. So, I mean, I see some unusual signs coming out of Kazakhstan, although, you know, Kazakhstan economy is in much better shape than compared to other Central Asian countries. But this closure of borders to, I guess, migrant workers, I mean, Kazakhstan being one of those countries which were, I mean, a source of income for Central Asian migrants from other countries. So what we should understand from those decisions to close the border in terms of the impact of the pandemic to Kazakhstan's its own economy? Maybe remittances might not be as relevant to Kazakhstan as it might be to some other countries, but again, the pandemic hit every country's economy in different ways, right?
Yes, that's certainly true. And I think, you know, Kazakhstan is not alone in closing its borders, right? I mean, there was a lot of policy diffusion that we saw. So I think that, you know, what Kazakhstan was doing was not particularly unusual, though I think when we look at kind of caravans and migrant camps, I think that those relatively isolated cases got a lot more attention than kind of the normal migrant that actually stayed. Nevertheless, I think one thing that really marks migration in Kazakhstan, whether it's transit migration through Kazakhstan or migration to Kazakhstan or migration, you know, back home to Central Asian countries, is that it's a lot more opaque than what's going on in Russia. The data is not very clear, as well as the kind of social advocacy networks are not as developed. And therefore, it's really difficult to make clear statements about what the situation in Kazakhstan is, as well as, you know, the network of researchers that are working on migration in Kazakhstan. It's just not as developed. So certainly we have, you know, data coming from the International Organization for Migration and, you know, a few isolated scholars, but it's just much, much more difficult to get a clear picture of what's going on in Kazakhstan than it is in Russia.
Do we have any, Irina, maybe this question might be relevant to your interest. Do we have any data in terms of the unemployment in Kyrgyzstan? I'm just trying to find anything which we can draw a comparison to pre-pandemic era in terms of the unemployment. I mean, where I'm sitting in the United States, I mean, we had 30 plus million people lost their jobs during this time. I mean, it's the biggest economy of the world, but still the impact has been severe even to the biggest economy of the world. I mean, do we have any number to share in terms of the unemployment rate, which could be as a direct result of the impact of the pandemic or the remittances here?
I don't have a data about unemployment in Kyrgyzstan, the recent data, but I have the results of a survey among migrants in Russia during COVID-19, which says that 40% of labor migrants became unemployed due to COVID-19, compared with 23% of surveyed Russian citizens. This survey has been conducted by the Russian Presidential Academy of National Economy and by Warsawa. So I think that this data demonstrates a difference in vulnerability of migrants to become unemployed. So you can compare 40% and 23%. But as well, many migrants, as we know, depend on the informal economy, and then they will be even beyond such statistics as well. Right. So both internal migrants in Kyrgyzstan and those who work in Russia.
You know, there's another country in Central Asia which often misses, or rather is Turkmenistan. Again, there is no data to base our opinions on, but it's just such a tough situation there. Unlike other Central Asian countries, Turkmens mostly go to Turkey for labor work, and the trajectory of the Turkish economy has been downward for a long time. Unfortunately, as I said, I do not have any hard data, but anecdotal examples are of growing pain and human suffering on both ends, the ones who are in Turkey and people who depend on those remittances back in home. Bruce, any anecdotal examples to add in terms of the sharp decrease in remittances on the livelihoods of Turkmens and Turkmenistanis?
Yeah, no, again, I think you hit it right on the head when you said it's hard to get a handle on that because it's so opaque. You know, Turkmenistan never gives figures for practically, and in fact, I'm sure that if you ask someone in the Turkmen government, they'd say, we don't get remittances at all because we don't need them, which is totally false, but that would be more what I would expect their position to be on something like this. You know, certainly it hurts. And again, part of the problem with Turkmenistan, as it always is, you just can't see in there. When that money transfers over, you know, who knows what happens to it when it reaches a bank in Turkmenistan and someone comes to pick up the money. Can they get it right away? Is there a percentage that gets taken out for handling? I suppose there always was. Is it more now? You know, we just don't. It's hard to answer these questions because they have such a lead curtain around that country sometimes, especially on matters like this where it could be embarrassing to the government. So it's I haven't seen any proof about or evidence about what the situation is with that. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. It's very clear that Turkmenistanis are suffering because of this. I mean, on the top of that, the authorities there have been involved in activities that can be described as a harmful, to put it lightly. Like it became almost impossible to use official channels to send money to Turkmenistan or anyone sending money from Turkmenistan abroad, given the difference between the official and black market exchange rate. So, yeah, Irina, you know, we spoke about the Turkey and remittance from Russia, but you were also talking about remittances coming from Ukraine to Central Asia. Any thoughts to add in that?
No, I think that the situation with remittances from Ukraine to Central Asia has a similar trend, but also Ukraine experienced deeper economical crisis because of ongoing war in Donbass as well. So I think those migrants who used to work in Ukraine, so they we don't have much data about them because I think that because of the number is smaller and then we have less information about what's going on there, but the trend is similar.
Mm-hmm. So the economic impact is severe. So what the authorities have been doing to remedy these losses and what the future holds for the region? I guess some of you were hinting about this question a little bit earlier. So let's continue the conversation talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Irina Kuznetsova, a lecturer in human geography at the University of Birmingham, Karis Schneck, associate professor of political science at the Nazarbayev University, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Pride Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Pride Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the financial impact of COVID-19 to Central Asia, particularly in the context of loss and remittances. So, as I said earlier, you know, the loss has been huge. And again, Central Asia's economy has not been doing well already for a long time. So how they are coping with this loss? Maybe we can start with you, Karis. So what have you seen the Central Asian authorities doing to remedy this this loss, the pain that people are in due to the loss of this lifeline from Russia?
So there's a couple of things. Like many countries, the Central Asian countries, and I know for sure, certainly Kazakhstan has been giving payments to just to individual people. And I think this is a pretty common trend to try to get money into the hands of citizens and even citizens abroad as they're kind of, you know, stuck in Russia, trying to kind of make sure that they at least have a little bit of access to money. Obviously, the state of the Central Asian economies, with the exception of Kazakhstan, are fairly poor. And therefore, you know, that money doesn't go very far. Nevertheless, I think it is important to differentiate between the different countries because I think we do see different economic impact of the pandemic. So we recently, together with Edward Lemon and Noah Tucker, wrote a report on for the U.S. Institute of Peace. And in that, we found that the labor market in Uzbekistan is a little bit more resilient than what we see in some of the other countries. And so it wasn't so much that, you know, there was a dive into poverty for those Uzbeks that weren't able to go to Russia, but there was a kind of an underemployment sort of issue. So I think Tajikistan is certainly, because it's more remittance dependent, it's much worse off. And therefore, but the government also has fewer resources. And so these become like vicious cycles, I think, because it's difficult for governments to make decisions that actually make a big impact that aren't more than just kind of symbolic kind of cash transfers to individual families.
Mm-hmm. Has the Irina, maybe you would like to jump in here. Has the authorities in Kyrgyzstan or in Tajikistan has been able to provide anything to people who have lost their lifeline due to the impact of the pandemic?
I think, first of all, the government of Kyrgyzstan, they provided support to over 33,000 Kyrgyzstan citizens to return from Russia. So, and then mostly for women with children and the pregnant women. So they provided support to them. Regarding those families who left behind and who didn't receive remittances, I think that the pandemic again demonstrated the lack of attention to such group of population, because they never have been considered as vulnerable. And then during our project, AgroMig, where we study families left behind and migration in seven countries in the world, and including Kyrgyzstan, so our data demonstrate that the representatives of authorities in the local level, they're saying that we usually ask migrants to help us, right, to invest in infrastructure, but migrants usually are not considered as those who require some support as well, despite that there are discussions initiated by UNICEF, who discovered that at least 4% of children in Kyrgyzstan have both parents or working in Russia. But still, in terms of social policy, there are many, many gaps in this respect, and it's very difficult to receive any allowance and any benefits and to claim that you're actually in need. And obviously, Kyrgyzstan's economy is not in such a situation where they can provide such a rapid response. But again, it's opportunity to reconsider that. All and right. as well, yes, thank you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. I mean, you said like the authorities in Kyrgyzstan has helped 33,000 migrant workers from Russia to return back home. And do we have any data from other countries how many migrant workers might have returned during the last year or so because of the loss of income in Russia? Do we know anything, any hard data about that, about the rest of the region?
I would say that the number of those who returned is bigger. So the government provided charter flights and bus transfers for over 35,000 of people. But there were migrants as well who returned independently. And so I'm not sure about the number. It's very, very fluid information. But but as Kares said, that the main trend for migrants were to stay in Russia where it's possible, especially when the Russian government actually lifted some of the restrictions and prolonged the time where people can stay without registration.
I know earlier Bruce said Tajik authorities have been running charter flights. At least there were a couple of occasions in which they have done this, charter flights from Russia to Tajikistan. Any idea as to how many migrant workers might have returned through the official channels or unofficial channels because of the COVID-19 or the impact of COVID-19?
You know, I didn't see anyone that had a figure or a Tajik service. I know that they have been returning in the hundreds. You know, I mean, Kara said at the start of the program that most chose to stay there, so which is huge for the Central Asian governments, because as bad as things are, it would be much worse if they had to tens of thousands or even 100,000 or something return. It would really put a strain on the economy and the government's ability to do anything. But yeah, I mean, they've been returning them. You know, the problem is always going to be that obviously most don't want to go, you know, and then there's the you know, the health issues of bringing all kinds of people home. Certainly at the start, there was all kinds of holdups, because that's where the infection came from. In a lot of cases, was they, you know, Uzbekistan, for instance, when the government helped bring home people from Russia and other places, they came with the infection, you know, which it would have got there anyway, sooner or later. But a lot of people ended up having, and Kyrgyzstan was the same. They didn't evacuate those people. They'd been in Mecca and came back with it. And those were the first registered cases they had. So they're trying, you know. I think the interesting thing now is they're trying to get more of these flights. Certainly Tajikistan is trying to negotiate with the Russian government to get flights to Russia, to start bringing people back and get them employed in Russia again. You know, it's been noted already on the broadcast that the situation stabilized anyway, and a lot of people, you know they only go there for 5, 6, 7 months a year anyway. Maybe, you know, they were back already when the pandemic hit or came back shortly after, but they want to get back and get to work, and so they're trying to get flights organized to get people back into Russia. And of course Tajikistan says that they beat the coronavirus too. So they But they fall into the Turkmen category, where they say that nobody in their country has it anymore. But Russia sent health officials to talk, and they never did release much information on those talks just last month. So, but, you know, they did bring some people home, not a huge amount. But right now they're trying to get rid of them and get them back to Russia.
So you are saying that there is a problem for them to get back to Russia?
Well, they, you know, the flights, you know, there's a big question of, I think Russia, you know, Russia has its concerns.
So Russia is not letting them to come back?
Well, the last I knew, the Tajiks were still trying to negotiate these charter flights, but they've been doing that for months. Maybe one of our guests knows more recent news than me. Mm-hmm. As you know, I've been kind of on vacation recently. Right. But last I knew, they were still trying to arrange the charter flights to get people back, and all the countries are doing that. You know, well, all the big remittance countries, Uzbekistan's talking with Russia, Kyrgyzstan's talking with Russia. You know, everyone wants to get the people that... There's a lot of people that want to go back and make some money,
yeah.
At least hopefully make money, and they're stuck right now. Can only go by slow transportation, or, you know, but the flights, they're still limited at best, and in some cases they just don't run flights between the countries.
Right. Let's see how it goes with Russia. I mean, it looks like it will take a long time until those normal days will return, and where migrants will go back to Russia and start working as it used to be pre-pandemic. But until then, they have to survive. I mean, earlier you were talking about, Irina, the official number of 33,000 people who were returned to Kyrgyzstan from Russia through official channels. And of course, that's only a bulk of the information we have. I mean, there are unofficial channels through which people were coming back. So those people who have returned from Russia, either through official channels or privately on their own, what they have been doing, how they have been surviving in the country?
It depends from which area they are. And there are some migrants who were able before the pandemic to invest in agricultural development, such as horticulture or livestock. So those who have such a safety net, they're doing better than others who just, dependent on some seasonal works and jobs in Russia, Turkey, or somewhere else. But yes, so our observations from field work, which Asel Mirzakulova conducted, that those families who don't have any investments, any livestock or agricultural investments, they're really concerned about the future and have high risks of poverty.
Mm-hmm. Trying to negotiate to get them back to Russia is one thing, but other than that, on the policy level, Karis, have you seen any Central Asian countries putting out a policy level kind of plan to cope with the situation, even if those migrant workers returns to Russia? I mean, it will take long time for things to get normal. It has never been normal, but again, to get back to pre-pandemic level, you know, environment. In the meantime, until we are there, is there any policy plans that you might have seen coming out of authorities in Central Asia, any country in Central Asia, addressing this challenge and how to go through this until things get back to, let's say, normal?
Yeah, there's kind of, again, like I said, some kind of symbolic stopgap measures. And I think in some ways, the Central Asian countries are probably like many countries in the world that are just working on a crisis basis, right? And that's hard. It's hard to it's hard to make decisions in a really highly uncertain environment. And some do well, and some don't do well. But I guess one of the things that locks the Central Asian countries into sort of cycles of crisis and cycles of perpetual crisis is, again, because those migration is only growing to Russia. It's growing. It's resilient. It will bounce back as soon as those borders open, and we see lots and lots of pressure of migrants on the small kind of porous areas that are available in the borders to get to Russia already. But I think that, you know, because we've seen these cycles of kind of boom and bust, and, you know, after 2008, after 2014, that the Central Asian governments know that the migration channels will open up again. It will, you know, kind of save them. And, in some ways, this prevents them from having to make a really long-term sort of plan, because they know that eventually the borders will open and things will kind of go back to normal. And in that sense, they don't really have much, I think, in the way of alternative. And so they really do, make that a part of their long-term plan. And that's, I think that's really, I haven't really seen any big policy shifts away from the centrality of migration as a strategy for economic development.
So I'm just wondering then, is the current situation sustainable then? How long it can sustain? something like this?
Well, like I said, I mean, I think, you know, the Russian economy, I think, is really resilient. It's much more resilient than the Central Asian economies are.
Let's say until Russia again starts accepting migrant workers in the level that it used to be in the past. But until then, how long Central Asian countries can sustain under current situation without a kind of a concrete plan how to deal with the impact?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a bit speculative, I guess. But I think that, you know, people are pretty resilient, is my perspective. And people that are willing to migrate to go to different countries are also really resilient. They're able to kind of adapt to their environments. And if that means kind of living in lean years, then they can do that. Yes, we see that food consumption has gone down and things like this. Yes, I don't want to paint it in a rosy picture. These things are difficult. But I also think that the people of Central Asia are extremely resilient and they will be able to bear up against, you know, any sort of downturns. I mean, we've seen this before, right? This is nothing new in the Central Asian economies. We don't know how long this trend will be. It's very uncertain. But I think in the meantime, people will do what they need to do to get by. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Again, earlier I was looking into the World Bank information, I guess, like also reports earlier written about the impact of COVID-19. Again, that brings me to the question of resilience, Irina. In Tajikistan, I mean, people are talking about skipping meals, food, just to get by with this. I mean, I'm just wondering how, I mean, life has been tough in Central Asia anyway, even before the pandemic, but now they have to skip meals. And I'm just wondering how long this can sustain.
Yes, I think it's very difficult to answer because the resilience has its limits, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, we can only hope that when the first harvest will come, summer will start, so the probably just in terms of food, the situation will tiny bit improve. But again, you know, without cash, so what you can do? The only optimism which I think that we could have is to look at the data from Russia. So for example, the National Union of Constructors saying that 50% of construction companies in Russia, they have lack of builders at the moment, and partly because they don't have migrants labor forces because of the pandemic. So we hope that when the travel restrictions will be lifted and people will be able to go back and to work, so the situation will improve. But again, it's a lot beyond Tajikistan's control or people's control. So I think that the limitations of this resilience, this unpredictability.
Yeah. And also, again, we don't even know when vaccine will reach to Central Asia, if indeed it does, at what level that's going to be available to people. I mean, we are talking about the long-term consequences of this situation. It's maybe not a good comparison here, what I'm trying to say. Like in America, which is producing like three of those vaccines, they are vaccinating like around 2 million and plus people every day. But at the same time, the news from today is like there was a sharp reduction in the COVID cases for the last couple of days. Now it is flattening again, so that the sharp decrease seems to be stopped over the past 2 days. So we are in uncertain situation, Bruce. So in the meantime, looking into Central Asia, do you have to face this challenge, not only the health crisis, but the economic crisis, the loss of income? So what I'm thinking about is, yes, one day Russia might open up. Yes, one day vaccines might be available for everyone in the region, like anyone else around the world. But until then, they have to survive. I'm just wondering how bad can it get before it gets better?
You know, Irina made a good point about mentioning the harvest. Certainly the coming months, you know, the winter is coming to an end. That's one good thing, although that won't help them with their food supply for many weeks and several months probably. But if they can get that far, that will help a lot. I mean, it's different in, you know, from country to country, and it really, I suppose, says something about the politics. You know, a country like Uzbekistan will probably weather this because, you know, the government has that heavy hand. And people know it. You know, they're unhappy, and certainly they've come out in the streets and demonstrated more than they would have in Karimov's time, or certainly that we've seen in, you know, a decade or more. But they also, there's also that implied message that, you know, the only so much is tolerable to the government. And so I think they'll probably get by. In any case, Uzbekistan's economy is largely self-sufficient. So it's you know, it helps them, and especially at a time like this when you have to depend on imports so much, like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, then you're kind of, it complicates the situation and really hinders the government. But you know, just to take that a little further, Kyrgyzstan, I think, is probably the country where you'll end up seeing the most problems. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of discontent and a lot of hungry people across the region. But Kyrgyzstan, because of all the tumult that they had, you know, with the leadership changes and everything like that, they have a new leader who really, you know, and I've said this in shows, previous shows, there's not a lot he can do to change the situation. He can't change the food situation. He can't change the economic situation, and he can't change the healthcare situation in his country either. You know, and you have to wonder how long people's patience there is going to last, because they were hoping, you know, some people voted for this guy hoping that he would be able to make things much better.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, that's the one country where patience is going to be like razor thin for this kind of stuff. In Tajikistan, they might be able to get away with it, you know. In Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, they'd probably get away with it. Kazakhstan is not as severe as we've heard, and won't be in the future. But I think Kyrgyzstan is really the one to watch, because
Bruce, on Kyrgyzstan, I mean, there has been lots of activities in terms of the rallies and demonstrations in Kyrgyzstan. In any way, in shape and form, these things came up during those protest rallies, like as a kind of a source of discontent?
You know, I haven't seen that, because everyone was against they were either against the Constitution or against Japarov himself, or, you know, we just had March 8th. So, and it's not the first time that they've had marches against violence against women, things like that too. So that those are still the main issues. But, you know, the price for basic goods went up on the average like 12% last year in Kyrgyzstan, just for like basic foods. And there were several articles saying that among the Eurasian economic community, Kyrgyzstan just got hit by far the worst of any of those countries. So that didn't do anything for them. We know that the water in Toktogul is low this year, so they're probably going to end up paying slightly more for electricity, or there could be outages. I don't know. So, you know, a lot of things pile up. And like I said, it's not like this government is doing a worse job than previous governments. I wouldn't say this current government's doing a good job, but most of the previous governments had a lot of problems too. But there's all these problems piling up that they just can't deal with. And I don't think that the Kyrgyz people, it would be interesting to see how long they go before they decide that the government's inept and isn't getting anything done to solve any of their problems, and decides to go out in the street and get rid of them, which a lot of people have expected is what's going to happen.
Another big political event is coming up on April 11th, I guess, with the referendum on the constitution. Let's see how things goes. But unfortunately, at the same time, we need to wrap the discussion very soon. But just a couple of last points here. So let's hope and imagine that the things will return to some sort of normalcy. But how do you see at what form in shape those countries might come out of this crisis situation? Let's start with you, Karis, and then Irina and Bruce. Also, where your eyes will be to determine what direction things might go from here.
Yeah, already we're seeing that migrants are getting into Russia through, I mean, the policy, the border closure policy has certain exemptions for things like medical needs or various other, you know, visiting family and things like this. And migrants have been using those policy exemptions in order to get into Russia. So getting some sort of medical certificate from their home countries and going into Russia, you know, so we're already seeing like kind of pockets of movement into Russia. And I really do think, you know, one of the major factors will be not only how soon Russia opens its border, but also what Russia's migration policy is going to look like in the future. So, you know, we've seen in the past year that they've really kind of liberalized in a sort of an emergency sort of way policies on registration and policies on patents. And if those trends continue, which I'm not sure that they will, then that would really help facilitate migrant movement into Russia. So the only last point that I wanted to make is that, you know, those migrants in Russia actually have kind of better access to things like the vaccine than their compatriots at home do. But I think that the important question for Central Asia is not access to vaccine, it's willingness to take vaccines. And so I think this is true both for the migrants in Russia as well as Central Asians. And Kazakhstan is actually the most vaccine hesitant in this regard, but also less affected by migration. So I think, you know, depending on whether governments put into place travel restrictions that require vaccines, we might see some movement on those trends, but we'll just kind of have have to wait and see. But I'm always looking to Russia's policymaking because I think that, and combined with, you know, kind of macroeconomic shifts, really tends to determine what the migration flows are.
Okay, on the same question to you, Marina. In the meantime, I should say that I like Karis's optimism in terms of those migrants coming back to Russia, you know, the signal about the movement that she was referring to. So, Irina, where your eyes will be as things continues the way it is, and again, of course, there might be a light at the end of the tunnel, but until then, you know, we have to survive. Same question, like if and when Central Asian countries coming out of this situation, how, in what shape and form they will come out, and where your eyes will be, how things will go from here?
I think that I will better talk about migrants, so it's very difficult for me. I'm not an economist to talk about how the economies of Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan will bounce back. So I think that it's a broader question. But I think that as Karis, so I will probably look at the window of opportunities, and then the pandemic demonstrated the urgency among migrants, and then the mutual self-help and the role of diaspora when COVID-19 started, both in supporting those who were not able to return and those who lost their jobs. And I think that because they can't rely mainly neither to the Russian government or government of the home countries, so this pandemic demonstrated that the role of diasporic organizations need to be increased, and it will be. At the same time, there are lessons for the governments of countries of our region. And again, as I mentioned, Kyrgyzstan doesn't have a fair migration policy. So it is a mediator, let's say, of migration, but it needs to be more attention to those families who left behind, and to have some lessons from the pandemic, and to provide necessary measures in case if it will repeat again because of another pandemic, touch wood, or because of another economic crisis.
Okay, Bruce, final point from you. As the uncertainty kind of continues with lots of challenging situation with no recovery plan on the horizon on behalf of the Central Asian countries, so where your eyes will be to determine where we are headed from here?
There's so many things that are probably going to happen once the situation starts to ease a little bit. I mean, how fast will Tajikistan join the Eurasian Economic Union? And what will Uzbekistan's view be on that, too? Because at least, you know, with the Kyrgyz, and lots of people made this point, I mean, because they're part of it, the situation is a little better for them when they're in Russia than it is for the other one. So, you know, there's that aspect to look at. But I'm going to be curious about is, obviously, every country in the world is going to try to be more self-sufficient. If there's one lesson I think every country learned, it's that if you have to depend on other countries for imports and vital goods, you could end up waiting for a long time. But in the Central Asian case, while it did, there were signs that they cooperated better during the pandemic. But there were also signs that they didn't, you know, I mean, Turkmenistan, of course, which is always the outlier, denying that it even had that. They have to be able to cooperate better in many different spheres. But certainly this shows that they really have to be able to cooperate better together when it comes to healthcare, dealing with a situation like this. You know, they haven't had to before so much. But I know because I wrote a report about Turkmenistan's healthcare system that Turkmenistan hasn't cooperated at all. They don't have many exchange programs with the neighbors. You know, so hopefully they would come out of this and, you know, get closer together, cooperate more, coordinate some of their healthcare policies, but also food and energy policies, which really would have helped them at this time. You know, the unified energy grid, if it was working, it would have helped with a lot of problems they have, you know, with heating and electricity. And certainly there are countries that have agricultural powerhouses. Kazakhstan grows a lot of wheat. Uzbekistan grows a lot of fruits and vegetables. If they could figure out deals among themselves, even if it's only during a crisis situation or something, so they could deal with this regionally instead of individually, that would certainly help them.
Yeah, let's see. Let's hope for more collaboration, more cooperation to be the lesson drawn from this situation. Okay, with this, we have to conclude the discussion here. Thank you very much, Bruce Pioneer, the editor of Ready for Free Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Also, big thanks goes to Irina Kuznetsova, a lecturer in human geography at the University of Birmingham, Karis Schneck, associate professor of political science at the Nazarbayev University. Again, thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Ready for Free Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.